The dandelions. Dandelions are a wonderful thing. There's great good in the dandelions, you know. And of course, the best part of all is the flowers themselves. You pluck the flowers off them and you boil them up in a pot. Put a couple of pounds of sugar in, a little bit of yeast to get them going, and leave them sit for a month or two, and you get the loveliest wine that you ever tasted. And I'm going to sing you a song about it, actually. When I was very small, my grandmother told me two things in life are finer than fine: to love when you're young, and then when you're older, to dream by the fire with dandelion wine. Dandelion wine will make you remember the first days of spring in the middle of the summer. Dandelion wine, dandelion wine, dandelion wine, dandelion wine.
Hello, and welcome to episode 2.17. The May 3rd, 2023, Dandelion Edition of Notes from the Aisle Seat, the podcast that covers the arts in Northern Chautauqua County, sponsored by the 1891 Fredonia Opera House. My name is Tom Laughlin, and I'm your host as we bring you news and information about arts events at the Opera House and around the region, including interviews with artists and creators across the county. I'm sure many of you share the same memory I have about picking a bouquet of dandelions for your mother on Mother's Day. Dandelions are everywhere at the beginning of May, and most people consider them a nuisance, a weed to be eliminated with sprays and chemicals. But surprisingly, the dandelion is actually an herb, and a pretty useful one at that. Fun facts about the dandelion. According to the Cleveland Clinic website, dandelions are chock full of nutrients, such as vitamins A, C, and K, folate, and calcium. The entire plant is edible and provides several types of antioxidants. They can reduce inflammation, help manage blood pressure, control blood sugar, and lower cholesterol. And when fermented properly, they make a fine wine. So, don't be too quick to judge the dandelion as a weed to be eliminated. Instead, you might consider picking them, washing them well, and tossing them into your next salad. If Johannes Vermeer had painted dandelions, it would have made a lot of sense, as he was a master at making extraordinary paintings from everyday experiences. The next art and architecture series at the Opera House, entitled Vermeer, the Blockbuster Exhibition, features the works of Vermeer in a once-in-a-lifetime exhibit of almost all his known works. Naturally, I reached out to my go-to expert on painting, distinguished professor of art emeritus, Alberto Rey, to get his insights into the work of Vermeer. As always, when I have something of significance to talk about in the art world on these exhibition on-screen presentations, I usually try and tap the mind of professor emeritus of art, Alberto Rey. Alberto, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, Tom.
So we have coming up at the 1891 Opera House at one of these exhibition on-screen presentations, Art and Architecture, and it's a documentary on the life of Johannes Vermeer, and he was one of the so-called great Dutch masters of the 17th century. And apparently, I'm not sure I'm pronouncing this museum right, but the Rijksmuseum in Amsterdam is having this amazing retrospective of his work, and every ticket is already sold out. You can't get in. What does that tell you?
I actually had a friend, a curator in Vermont, who went last week. I think she got back last night. She went with her mother. And tickets originally sold for $32, but people were scalping them for $750. Because I think the exhibition has 28 of the 35 known paintings, and this is the most paintings ever presented of his work. So, and it's very difficult to get these paintings because of impermanent collections, and not every museum wants to lend it out because of the wear and tear from transportation and liability. So, it's kind of thing that you probably won't see an exhibition like this again for several decades. So everybody wanted to be able to see this really rare collection of his work.
Yes, I read that the curator who was going to appear, I think, in this particular exhibition on screen and talk a little bit about that said he was absolutely, kind of stunned that he was able to pull it together because his work is spread across so many museums, and he was shocked that so many museums actually said yes. But let's talk a little bit about let's get into Johannes Vermeer. I think most people will recognize him the minute you see a Vermeer painting, because it's like nothing else. But let's first talk about his background, because I find his background to be, sort of interesting in terms of the kind of life he led.
Yeah, I mean, his father was a worked in fabrics, selling silk, and he did pretty well for himself until he decided to open up an inn, and which kind of put him in the red. And unfortunately for his family, he died fairly early on in his life. He got into a fight with a soldier and soon after passed away, leaving the inn to Vermeer. His father was also an art dealer, so his son Vermeer was able to kind of get a feeling for the practice, the business of being an artist. But he married into wealth. His wife came from a wealthy background. They ended up having 15 kids, four of which passed away fairly quickly, but they still had 11 kids. So he has 11 kids. He moved into his mother-in-law's house, which was much bigger than what he had. And then he was an art dealer and running the inn. So people think that this might have been the reason that he only made 35 paintings, or actually he made 50 paintings, of which 35 have survived, or people know where they are.
One of the things that people talk about when they talk about Vermeer's work and his uniqueness or his is his subject matter. He really paints pictures of ordinary everyday things. I mean, almost all of his paintings are one or two people in a room doing something completely ordinary, and that's kind of also a little bit stunning.
Yeah, I think in the previous episode we talked about Caravaggio and his use of light. And I think the same thing can be said for Vermeer. I think one of the things that is really quite striking about his work is not only that it's accessible and it is mostly the middle class, but just how much he controls his light. It's usually one light source, maybe a secondary light source for added detail, but it's mostly coming from one light source. And the way he paints it is just so beautiful. It's like a moment in time that, either you're pouring some milk from a vase or somebody's reading a letter, or just very simple, mundane episodes in life that we can almost kind of connect with, that these aren't, monumental things that are happening. These are just everyday experiences that he's portraying for us. And he portrays it in a manner that is so real that it does give us an interpretation of what life was like back then. And it's just, you know, really moving. It's almost like a spiritual experience when you look at his paintings.
Well, you know, one of the ones that always strikes me, I mean, people talk about the Mona Lisa and her smile as being haunting, but there's a painting he's got called The Girl with the Pearl Earring. And, mm-hmm. you know, this is a young woman who's sort of looking over her shoulder. You can see the pearl earring. But the thing that catches me about that painting is her eyes. Her eyes are just remarkable to look into when you sort of pay some attention and almost stare right back at them.
Yeah, it's, you know, one of the things that people, or a lot of people talk about is the use of the camera obscura. And one of the things, how that light kind of reflects on the pearls and on the eyes, they, you know, a lot of scientists and artists feel that that's kind of an indication that it uses a camera obscura because of how that light is reflected. And that's a kind of a debatable thing about, you know, did he use this kind of scientific technique to understand the figure? One of the things that people do agree is that the camera obscura really was used for understanding perspective lines and how the space is organized, but the technology wasn't so good that it would give you this kind of photorealistic interpretation like he does in his paintings. And I think the painting you're talking about, the girl with the pearl earring, is not only because of the eyes, but if you look at the lips, they're just so relaxed. It's kind of like she's about to say something or just said something. And it's, again, that moment in time that is just breathtaking.
Yeah, it's almost like you catch her in a moment by surprise. It's almost like she's looking behind her and she says, oh, there you are. You just walked mm-hmm. into the room mm-hmm. And you just caught her a little bit by surprise. And yet, you know, that painting probably took about, you know, 2 years to create, because I think he worked at a rate where he maybe put out maybe two or three paintings a year at most,
right.
With that kind of detail, you know?
Yeah. You know, when he paints that few number of paintings, every painting is pretty much priceless. Back in 1990, there was a theft of one of his pieces at Boston's Gardner Museum. And it was the concert, which was, you know, three people, two women and a gentleman, kind of one playing the piano or the harpsichord there, and the other one singing. And one of the things that's interesting about that painting and what happened in 1990 is that I used to go to that museum, you know, every other year, because it's just a stunning museum. And it's got this beautiful Sargent there as well. But people, you know, it's, you know, that was 1990. That's 30 years ago. You know, I've almost forgotten what that painting looks like. I mean, apart from looking at photographs, but I remember sitting there looking at it, and there's going to be a time pretty soon where there's not going to be anybody alive who remembers that. Because it's been so long since it's disappeared. And, you know, there's always a lot of theories about what's going on with that. But again, it's never showed up. And so this is a beautiful painting that is one of the very few that he created. And it's lost. It's lost for everybody. And that's just a pity.
Let's talk a little bit about Vermeer's technique and specifically his use of pigment. He was one of the few people who used the kinds of pigments that he did. And it's interesting to try to ascertain how he came about using some of those pigments, because according to my research, Vermeer was never taught by anyone. He was nobody's pupil. And so everything that he sort of developed in his style and in his paintings, you know, came from himself. And these pigments that he chose were not cheap pigments. They were very expensive and very rich.
Yes, they were, I think, especially the ultramarine, which is came from Afghanistan. So, you know, it was ground up stone that was hard to find. And, you know, these days you get these hues that are artificially made pigments. And then you have the types of pigments that they used, and they're still available now. But anytime that you use, you know, like ground up stone or rocks that have these colors, they're much more permanent and don't fade like some other paints like watercolor or something like that. So when he was using not only the ultramarine, but the vermilion and the Madder's Lake, which is a form of red, he was really, you know, committing to his craft by selecting these pigments that are hard to get to. You know, one can only speculate where this funding was coming from, but, you know, he was pretty much, you know, spending or committing this money that he could have been using for other things like his family or his business. But instead, he was making these paintings. And again, they're beautiful paintings. And anytime he uses the vermilion, you can see that it's a key element in the painting, that, you know, the red really draws you in. And the same thing with the ultramarine. They are key elements that really draw you in. And you can only imagine at the time when you would see these paintings and some of these pigments that weren't available, that people would just be, you know, immediately drawn to it because they had not seen anything of this saturation anywhere else. And so that was a selling point as well, I'm sure, when he was making these works. So it is interesting, which is another reason that people try to make an argument for using the Camera Obscura, because they, you know, they just have a hard time believing that this kind of self-taught artist would have this much skill in portraying texture and fabric and skin tones just by figuring it out with himself, and only by making those few paintings. I mean, he was, there wasn't much work that he missed. I mean, that he wasn't right on the ball. You know, most other artists make hundreds, if not thousands, of paintings in their lifestyle, in their lifetime, so that they have time to grow and learn. And it's kind of hard to believe that he got this skill so quickly.
Well, listen, Alberto, thank you very much. I appreciate your time, as always. I'm always glad to have you on the show. And I think people are really going to enjoy this particular exhibit because nobody can get a ticket to it. So being able to see this exhibit on screen and get those close-ups and the commentary and see these works all in one place, this should be a fascinating experience.
Absolutely, absolutely. And Tom, it's always a pleasure working with you. One little pitch I would make is,
please do,
if you, well, two things. One is, if you ever get a chance to look at a Vermeer, please do so. I mean, again, that experience in Boston has told me that, you know, if you have a favorite painting or some art you want to see, it's well worth traveling to see it, because you never know what's going to happen. The other thing is, I have a solo exhibition up at the Niagara University at the Castellani Museum. It'll be up for another 8 months or so, but it's about the Niagara River. It's 9 6-foot paintings and a huge map mural that some people might find interesting.
Oh, people will always find your work interesting, as I do, Alberto. I'll be sure to make sure I get up to take a look at that. And we'll put a link in the show notes for it so people can get more information for sure.
Thank you.
Okay, thanks again. Have a good time and enjoy Well, enjoy the spring, man.
Yeah. If we ever get it back again.
Yeah, right. Take care, Alberto.
All right, thanks, Tom.
Vermeer, the blockbuster exhibition, will be screened at the 1891 Fredonia Opera House on Saturday, May 6th at 1 p.m. Tickets are $15 for adults, $10 for students, or you can use one of your Flex subscription passes. The Art and Architecture series is generously sponsored by Dr. James and Marcia Merens. Since 2001, the Buffalo Gay Men's Chorus has been fulfilling its mission of performing vocal music of high quality in the rich tradition of men's choral singing, as well as serving as an expression of pride and solidarity in the LGBTQ+ community. The Fredonia School of Music has the honor of having the artistic director of the BGMC, Dr. Robert Strauss, on its voice faculty. He has often appeared on the podcast as an expert on opera for the Live at the Met series, and it was more than a joy to get him on this episode to discuss the upcoming BGMC performance at the 1891 Fredonia Opera House. Well, joining me now is a member of the SUNY Fredonia voice faculty, Dr. Rob Strauss, who is the producer of the Hillman Opera, but he's not joining me for that this time. A lot of times I get him as a guest, and we talk a little bit about an upcoming Live at the Met, but this time I have him in his position as the artistic director of the Buffalo Gay Men's Chorus, and they are coming down to the Opera House for a concert, a pretty significant concert, too, on Saturday, May 13th at 7:30 p.m. So, Rob, welcome to the podcast with your other hat on.
Thank you. And does anybody still wear a hat? Apparently, I wear like 40.
I do wear a hat. And the only reason I wear a hat is because, you know, I don't want the cold escaping out of the top of my head. So, it's either the cold out of the top of my head or it's the sun baking my bald pate. So, you know.
Well, since this is audio, I'm going to say I have a beautiful head of hair that protects me from the sun, but it's all a lie.
You lucky dog, you. Okay, so the Buffalo Gay Men's Chorus is coming down, and that's a terrific thing. I think this is a real coup for the Opera House. You're coming down to do a highlight from the programs. There's all kinds of things from the Social Justice Songbook. We've got right. New composers. We've got so many things going on. So I think for the first thing I'm going to ask you to do for any of my listeners who are listening who are not aware of the history of the Buffalo Gay Men's Chorus, just give us a little background on how it got started, how long it's been around, and all that kind of jazz.
Okay, great. It's been around since 2001, sort of before that, because they did all their homework on how to get 501c3, nonprofit, tax exempt, all the things. That artistic directors don't worry about all the time, so I won't be very articulate. But they laid the groundwork and they hired an artistic director, which was not me. I joined them in 2019. And actually, their first rehearsal was scheduled for September 11th, 2001.
Oh, wow.
For those of the listeners who remember that day. Mm-hmm. So they did have rehearsal that night. They didn't necessarily do a lot of singing. But one piece that they did sing was the Quaker tune, How Can I Keep From Singing, mm-hmm. which was very important to them on that night. And it has been the theme song of this chorus ever since. And I'll tell you, through the pandemic, when we were trying to have rehearsals online and putting together virtual choir videos, How Can I Keep From Singing took on a whole different meaning at that point. So we will be singing that at the Opera House as well.
You're a large group, I mean, relatively speaking. That's not a small number of men you have. I think it's up to what, 80? Is it something like that?
It has been up to 80. Time has, that would have been probably the early 2010s mm-hmm. at that point. But I'll say the pandemic has done a number on all choral groups. Mm. And our numbers are closer to 30 at this point, between 25 and 30. But I went to a tea last Sunday, which sounds like something the artistic director of a Buffalo Gay Men's Chorus would do, but it was all the choral groups of the greater Buffalo area, and they're all experiencing the same thing. But I'll tell you, my 30 or so singers are really dedicated to it and work really, really hard. So they're putting a lot of time and effort into rehearsing between rehearsals, which is awesome, so that we do a really great show at the Opera House.
So let's talk about the show coming up now, too, because I think you got some very significant things going on. This is going to be a program entitled Stronger Than Silence. And so can you talk a little bit about first about the title? What prompted the title?
Stronger Than Silence has to do with the fact that so many marginalized communities, like the LGBTQ plus community, the members just sort of try to hide, try to pass as something that they're not. They try to pass as straight, or they try to pass as, you know, white, or take on more masculine if they're working in a sexist environment, taking on more masculine, rather than just being who they are and raising their voices, even just by being themselves. So this concert really is, of course, specifically about the LGBTQ plus community, because that's who we are and who we represent. But it's about how, by raising our voices, we are stronger, we are better, we are seen and heard and can be taken seriously and have discussions and make improvements. And so on and so forth. So that's the gist of the theme of the concert.
Yeah, and it's a really, you know, this is a moment in time right now where LGBTQ plus communities are having so many struggles across the country now. There was a period of time where we thought we had made a lot of progress and gay marriage was being very accepted, and all of a sudden now it seems like we're going backwards. And so a concert like this, I think, is really important to make sure that we keep that forward momentum of acceptance going, I think, both for the straight community as well as the LGBTQ plus community.
Well, I think so. And we've had really great conversations. You know, so many of our members are of an age. Sometimes I joke, I'm not sure it's a joke, that I'm still younger than the average age of the group. Now, there are members who are much younger than I am, so I don't want to insult them if they listen to this in any way, shape, or form. But, you know, I know what you're saying, and I felt that too, like we're moving backwards. But I just think the discussions are becoming more nuanced. And so even within our group, we've had to have discussions about what's going on with pronouns. What is this all about? And you know, some older gay men don't understand that. And so we can have those discussions and either be made to understand or not. But I think it's so fascinating, the discussions that are happening with gender identity and sexual orientation, that, you know, back in my day, we were just fighting for gay. I'm not sure that's the way to say it. But things were a little bit more black and white, or this or that.
Yes.
And so the discussions now are a lot more, well, some of these things are a little blurry for some people.
Well, and I believe I'm a little older than you, so it even goes back a little bit further, back into my day when, you know, Stonewall happened. So, yeah. I mean, wow. When I remember reading about that in the paper and really not comprehending it as a teenager to today, man, you know, the progress is amazing. And I think that, you know, keeping that momentum going is so important. Let's talk about some of the pieces you're going to do. What would you like to start with?
Well, I feel like I should start with the people that I think people would recognize, or the pieces that I think people would recognize. Just so that you know, even though the concert theme's perhaps a little heavy, we do have some lighter music. I think most people would recognize Bridge Over Troubled Water, the Simon and Garfunkel song from back in the day. And I mean, the message is clear. We're also performing He Ain't Heavy, He's My Brother, from the same era, of course, but also about supporting each other and standing up for each other, which is wonderful. We're singing a number of pieces from, as you mentioned, the Social Justice Songbook, which was put together by the Gay and Lesbian Association of Choruses, to which we belong. And those are pieces, I don't want to scare audience members off, I'm not going to force you to sing. As a performer, I don't always like audience participation, because I feel like you should be paying me to do this. But there are opportunities in those songs. They're kind of call to action songs that that have a component of audience participation in them. One of them paraphrases a Beatles song, as a matter of fact, pretty recognizable, and quotes Lin-Manuel Miranda, as a matter of fact. I don't think either of them are credited. So I hope none of those people are listening to this. No, it's not my fault. It's not my fault at all. But I do want to talk about Warmth Is My Home, is a piece that we're premiering on this concert. The text was created out of answers to a survey that we put out to the LGBTQ plus community in Buffalo, using our chorus, using GLIS Western New York, the Pride Center of Western New York, to get these surveys out. And the survey asked questions like, what would you tell your younger self if you're an LGBTQ plus community member? What would you tell your younger self? Or what surprised you about the coming out process, either good or bad? What are your hopes for the LGBTQ plus community or society as a whole? And so the composer looked at the answers to those surveys and put together the text for this piece. And the composer is an alum of the Fredonia School of Music, the composition area, Mickey Wadsworth, who themselves are part of the community, a non-binary individual. And they have put together this really, really interesting piece of music. It has what in the scholarly world is called aleatoric music. Sometimes we call it chance music, but it requires the members of the chorus to decide when they're doing certain things, reading certain things, singing certain things throughout a section, so that every performance is different. But I'll tell you, the one at the Fredonia Opera House will be the best one. And that's why you'll want to go to that one. but every performance will be different. And actually, Mickey is able to attend the performance at the Opera House, so that's exciting too.
They'll
have to be there, and I hope we make them proud.
Well, you know, and I hope they'll be glad to be home there too.
Absolutely. So it's really lovely, and we're also doing a piece called Names, which was written by a Rochester area composer for a musical that he wrote, but he rearranged it for me to perform with my groups. It's got a little bit of a gospel flair, and in that we'll be paying tribute to trans women of color who have lost their lives over the last 12 months. They tend to be the most targeted group of individuals. And you talked about Stonewall, and that was started by a trans woman of color. So we'd like to, as you say, we'd like to think things are getting better. And maybe they are, but they can get a lot better yet.
Yes, they can get a lot better, and God knows we're hoping for that. What about the? I think you also have a performance of a. Did we talk about Peace by Martin Wimmer?
No, that's, you know, this was in the BGMC library, Buffalo Gay Men's Chorus BGMC. As I say, I took the job in 2019, right before the pandemic. I was interim and got the full-time job in 2020. It speaks to my intelligence that I would take a job with a chorus during a pandemic, but hopefully they've lucked out as a result of my ignorance or stupidity. But
Rob, you are such a self-effacing man. I see. It's...
Well, you know,
for all your talent and wonderfulness, you know.
Thank you. In any case, I dug through their library because, you know, they'd existed already for 18 years, and I found this piece called Peace. That's a homonym. They're two different words. Mm-hmm. But Martin J. Wimmer works for WNED. He's an announcer, and mm-hmm. we did some work with him a couple of years ago. And it's a really gorgeous piece. It combines a Chinese proverb: when there's peace at home, there's peace. I paraphrased hugely because I don't have it in front of me, but we've probably heard that Chinese proverb, and yes, the Dar No Bis Pacem of Judeo-Christian traditions. Mm-hmm. It's a really beautiful work. And I'm thrilled to be revisiting it. So yes, in this concert, we actually have lots of contemporary composers, living composers. We also, I'd love to say it was on purpose, and I always mean for it to be on purpose, but there's a number of works by women composers as well on this. So I hope that we're showing not just giving a great performance, but inadvertently exposing us all to different conversations that can be happening, giving people a seat at the table.
Yes, and I think the amazing thing about this is that given all of these particular pieces and the range and span of their subject matter, they're all coming also from the Western New York area. I mean, we can't forget that this is a very, very local performance of local composers who are doing this kind of composition work.
Sure. Sure, absolutely. And a huge variety. You're going to be mad at me for making fun of myself again, but my programs, they always suffer from my attention span. I love all different kinds of music, but not for a very long period of time. But before I want to move on to a different style or listen to something different. So if you're like me and you do love all different kinds of music, well, I think that you'll like the whole concert. But if there are kinds of music that you don't like, well, you only have to last 5 minutes before we'll move on to something stylistically quite different. So.
Now, I usually try to keep my program here regional, but I also know you're doing a performance of this in Buffalo as well, right after the Opera House. Where's that going to take place?
That's a week later, Saturday the 20th, also at 7:30. That's at the Tacoma Performing Arts Center, which is a newish venue. It's a renovated church up on Tacoma Avenue near Colvin and Hurdle. So if you're desperate to go and just cannot go, I would recommend that you donate money to the Opera House because they're wonderful, and then come see us in Buffalo.
So Rob, thank you so much. It's a very exciting event at the Opera House. It's unique, and I'm glad that you and Rick Davis got together to be able to bring it to the Opera House.
I'm thrilled he said yes.
Yeah. So are we all, I think. And hopefully this won't be the last time. I mean, we'd love to have you guys. I mean, I would, but that's another story. We every year and do a concert at some particular point in time, and surely we can make that happen.
Well, we're going to give a really great show, and hopefully that'll inspire an invite.
Dr. Robert Strauss, as always, thank you. I appreciate your time. I know also this is not going to be the last. You'll be back for another Live at the Met discussion, and we'll have a good time then, okay?
I'd be thrilled. Thanks.
All right. Thanks, Rob. Bye-bye.
The Buffalo Gay Men's Chorus presentation of their program, Stronger Than Silence, will be presented at the 1891 Fredonia Opera House on Saturday, May 13th, beginning at 7:30 p.m. Tickets are $25 for adults, $20 for Opera House members, and $10 for students. Tickets can be obtained online at www.fredopera.org/tickets or by calling the box office at 716-679-1891. Here is the arts calendar for the upcoming 2 weeks. The Department of Theater and Dance will present its final production of the year, Lear, from Thursday, May 4th through Saturday, May 6th at 7:30 p.m. in the Marvel Theater of the Rockefeller Arts Center. Written by two-time Obie winner Young Jean Lee, this absurdist tragedy has been described as a collision between Shakespeare's Lear, Sesame Street, and a father's mortality, as it follows the children of Lear and Gloucester after they turn their backs on their aging fathers. Tickets are available at the Fredonia campus box office by calling 716-673-3501 or online at www.fredonia.edu/tickets. The School of Music finishes out its academic year with a concert from the Fredonia Saxophone Quartet and Ensemble on Thursday, May 4th at 8 p.m. in the Rausch Recital Hall, a performance by the College Symphony on Saturday, May 6th at 8 p.m. in King Concert Hall, and the Masterworks Concert, featuring works by Mozart, sung by Fredonia Voice faculty members with the Western New York Chamber Orchestra, on Sunday, May 7th at 4 p.m. in King Concert Hall. Tickets for the Masterworks Concert are $20 general admission and are free to Fredonia students purchased in advance or $5 purchased at the door. Tickets are available through the Fredonia Campus box office, 716-673-3501. And remember, if you have an arts event coming up and would like to get it mentioned on the arts calendar, send an email to operahouse@fredopera.org or call the box office at 716-679-1891 with your information.
Sensation, darkness wakes and stirs imagination. Silently the senses abandon their defenses, helpless to resist the notes I write, for I compose the music.
The long-standing annual tradition of the Commencement Eve Pops Concert continues this year at the Rockefeller Arts Center with a presentation of the music of Andrew Lloyd Webber. This year offers a twist, with two alumni coming to join the student cohort of singers. I caught up with the director of the RAC, Mr. Jefferson Westwood, and also managed to have one of the guest alumni, Mr. Jordan Weatherston Pitts, to join me as well to talk about this long-standing event. There is nothing in the world I like better than being able to talk to Fredonia alum who comes back to do some work. And with the Commencement Eve concert coming up at SUNY Fredonia on Friday, May 19th at 7:30 p.m., we're going to have Jordan Pitts returning. So he is with me. Say hi, Jordan.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
I'm well. I'm well, thank you. And of course, it wouldn't be a podcast about for Commencement Eve without the producer and the director of the Rockefeller Arts Center, who is receiving his 40th year pin of service at the end of this year for the Rockefeller Arts Center. That's Mr. Jefferson Westwood. Hello, Jefferson.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me back.
Oh, as always, always good to have you. Jefferson, I'm going to start with you since you're the producer and you have most of the basic information, and then we'll talk to Jordan about his career and everything like that. So tell us, give us some background about the Commencement Eve. You've been doing it for a long time and it's always been a popular event.
Yeah, I've lost track. I think it's over 30 years now. But Grant Cooper, who used to be the conductor of the what's now the Western New York Chamber Orchestra, actually invented the idea of doing something for what was theoretically a captive audience of the parents coming in to pick up their kids. And it turns out that what the parents usually do is take them out to dinner and then help them pack their dorm room or their off-campus apartment. So it's mostly a community audience. But we've done a variety of shows, both with our regional symphony orchestra, Western New York Chamber Orchestra, or a big band. And we're sort of alternating years now. This is a year for the orchestra. And I thought, wouldn't it be great to do a whole evening of music by Andrew Lloyd Webber? So that's exactly what we have in store. We've got nine really talented students, mostly seniors and juniors, who will be singing. And we have the 26-voice Fredonia Chamber Choir under the direction of Vernon Huff. And then we have two fabulous alumni who are coming back to, in this case, Amanda Bottoms, and then Jordan Weatherston Pitts here with us will be singing four selections from the hit musical Evita.
Yeah, that's wonderful. It should be a particularly wonderful night. So Jordan, you're going to be singing the selections from Andrew Lloyd Webber's Evita. Now, your career has really taken off. I mean, I looked at your schedule. I looked at your bio. You've been doing some wonderful work and getting some amazing notices. Tell me a little bit about how your career has been going since you graduated.
Thank you. Yeah. Well, it's been certainly a wild ride. I think, you know, for a while I was sort of just, you know, all systems go until COVID. COVID really threw a wrench into a lot of plans I had, but it's nice now to have the momentum back. You know, like when I left Fredonia, I think what was the most amazing thing was just, you know, getting out into the young artist world and starting to really, you know, grow some roots in different places other than just Western New York, which, you know, I love Western New York, but I moved to New York City and I have been able to just do a bunch of really, really wonderful things with really, really talented people. I do everything from like big Puccini and Verdi stuff to bel canto to new opera and new music, which is a big part of my career. And yeah, I think it's just for me, I've just been grinding away, you know, working really hard at just becoming the artist that I have always wanted to be. And I don't know, I think I'm doing okay at the moment. So
I think you're doing fantastically. I mean, you've been a tenor soloist for the Hartford Symphony Orchestra with Beethoven's Ninth Symphony. You've played at the Lake Area Music Festival in Brainerd, Minnesota with the Rake's Progress. I could read this, the whole list of things that I see here, Macduff and Giuseppe Verdi's Macbeth. But, you know, I'm actually most interested in your 2018, you actually got to go to Hawaii to do work with Hawaii Opera Theater. And you played, you were the Romeo cover.
Yes, that was probably my most luxurious gig to date. I mean, let's be real. Like, I spent 4 months in Hawaii. I was a young artist at the Orvis Studio is what it's called at Hawaii Opera Theater. And I was in Hawaii for 4 months. And I, you know, when I first took that gig, I was thinking to myself, is this really, you know, a good idea? Like, you know, taking four months away from practically audition season, because that was in the fall.
Right.
And I remember, like, as soon as I got off the plane, it was like, yeah, this was the right decision. I'm totally fine with this decision. Missing out on New York City winter for 4 months, it was perfect. So.
Yeah, that had to be very, very, very exotic. And I also see you with the tenor soloist in the musical All Is Calm, which has been a big hit around Regents lately.
It has. Yeah, that was with New York City Opera just this past winter. Beautiful piece of music about the Christmas truce that I just really was. It was very emotional for all of us. The actual piece itself is all a cappella. There's no instrument. There's one instrument. There's a trumpet that plays taps at the end, but there's no instrumentation for the entire thing. And it was just a group of really, really talented guys. We got together and we rehearsed for almost like 2 months before we put it on. I mean, it was a real epic thing that New York City Opera put together. So yeah, thrilled about that one for sure.
Yeah, that's an amazing piece. It's been done a couple of times in Buffalo, always a big hit up there. So as you prepare to take on the music of Andrew Lloyd Webber in Evita, what is it about Andrew Lloyd Webber or the show or, you know, his style of music that excites you the most?
Well, Andrew Lloyd Webber is the sort of, you know, grandfather, I should say, of everything that started with my passions for music. I mean, like, Phantom of the Opera was one of the first things I ever saw. You know, I mean, my mother took me to go see, you know, we growing up in Buffalo, obviously we have fabulous productions at Shays Theater downtown in our theater district. But very often my mom and I would just try to go see Broadway shows in Toronto. Toronto was, you know, just a stone's throw away. So she took me to see Phantom. That was the first thing we ever went to go see together. I was hooked immediately. We saw Cats. I never got to see Evita live, but, you know, obviously recordings. But yeah, we saw Hairspray. We saw all kinds of things in Toronto. But I remember like seeing Phantom of the Opera, and that was the first thing that ever really exposed me to opera, believe it or not. I had never really known the genre before that. You know, it's not necessarily an opera, but from there I sort of like deep dived into the history of the art form. That's what got me interested in the art form. And I think that Andrew Lloyd Webber's music is just the blueprint for everything. You know what I mean? Like, there's a reason Cats went on for so long. RIP Phantom of the Opera right now. I mean, it's so sad that it's finally closed, but you know, there's a reason these shows go on for so long, is because the writing is phenomenal. And the way he writes for the voice, the things he's done for musical theater as a genre, I mean, it's incomparable. So I'm thrilled. Any time I get to sing his music, I'm always thrilled, always.
And Jefferson, I suppose that you picked Andrew Lloyd Webber for just even the sheer popularity of it. I believe the New York Times dubbed him the most popular composer of musical theater ever.
Yes, absolutely. I try to find show ideas that are going to have a wide and mass appeal. We actually had a touring group about 12, 13 years ago that did a show called The Songs of Andrew Lloyd Webber. And that was just three or four professionals out of California that had a six-piece band. But this is going to be a mammoth production by comparison. We have a 52-piece orchestra with pipe organ. And depending on the piece, like the stuff from Jesus Christ Superstar, we'll have electric guitar and, you know, bass guitar, as well as a standard symphony instruments. Father Sean Duggan is going to play the organ for us and the piano, and he's of course a Bach expert, but his fingers can do anything at any speed. He's an incredible technical technician on the keyboards, and so that's a real asset to the show. And we had auditions about a month ago, and we just have 9 wonderful students in the show as well. And you know, a few years ago, we did a 50th anniversary concert. We brought back about 12 alumni. That was a wonderful event. This is the first time, though, that we're actually combining current students with alumni, which is sort of a new model that I would love to do more of in the future.
Yeah, I think it will be an outstanding model, too, for both sides. I think the alumni will love to come and offer their wisdom to the current students, and the students will be excited to see how the alumni go out and have careers like Jordan is having. Jordan, let me come back to you just a little bit once again. You managed to, you know, perform in a musical called, or an opera, actually, I believe, called Stonewall with the New York City Opera. And that was a very significant piece in the musical world. It was a really breakthrough piece. How did you score that? And what was your takeaway from it?
So Stonewall is, you know, probably the most important thing I've ever done, and probably will. I'm not, you know, you never know about the future, but it is probably the single thing I've done in my career that I'm the most proud of and that I was most invested in as an artist. The role was essentially written for me, which was surprising. The way that it came about, you know, I had heard that the project was going on. I was doing another show with New York City Opera at the time called Dear Eric, which was another new work by a composer named Ted Rosenthal. It was a jazz opera taking place at the Jewish Heritage Museum down in the Battery. And Mark Campbell, who was a very famous librettist, Pulitzer Prize winner, phenomenal, just like individual, you know, he was talking to me at one of our receptions about Stonewall. And he said, you know, I heard you singing. I think you'd be really great for this role. I know that you know, have some experience in drag, you know, just around the city, which I had at that point, you know, because I've been doing drag sort of on and off since college, really. And I thought to myself, you know, yeah, of course, I'll audition. I didn't think anything of it. I thought it was just going to be a new opera, that it was sort of, you know, a project in the works with New York City Opera. But then all of a sudden, I got cast. I went into this audition for the director of New York City Opera, and he said, he asked me to bring a pair of heels, so I did. And I showed up and I sang, you know, I think they heard everything in my book. I sang like 6 arias, right? Mm-hmm. And Michael Capasso at the end of it, he said, congratulations, you have the role. And I'm like, okay, great, you know, phenomenal. Great, that's awesome. You know, I got cast on the spot. And I remember, you know, getting the score and thinking to myself, wow, like this is going to be difficult, you know, like this is going to be a real hard thing. But I showed up to the, we did a workshop in May of 2019. The actual production was like the end of June, like during Pride season. So we did the workshop for about 2 weeks. And I remember showing up, meeting Ian Bell, the composer, seeing Mark there, and the whole cast. I mean, there was this instant like family feeling, you know, more than any show I've ever done. I know we all get attached to our castmates and things like that, but I mean, it really genuinely was, there was like a magic in the air, where I felt immediately supported and loved and understood. And all of those people, you know, to this day are my closest friends. I mean, it's unreal. The actual show itself ended up getting pared down quite a bit, but the run of the show had phenomenal. I mean, I can't tell you how many interviews and press releases we did. You know, Cyndi Lauper was there, like Whoopi Goldberg talked about us, like there were all these things that were happening, you know. And I just was like, all of a sudden, like, you know, what is my life? I had never had that experience of a role being written for me. And I think to this day, it is the only operatic role written for a spinto tenor in drag. I think it is the only one. It also was the first opera that had ever been, there was a role written for a trans singer. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I mean, I could go on forever about the effects that it's had on new music, especially now Ian's writing is everywhere. But also like my life and the people that were involved. I mean, it's incomparable. So.
Good, good. Wonderful. Wonderful. Jefferson, before I have to leave this interview, can you just spend a couple of minutes? We've been dwelling upon, of course, Evita, because that's where Jordan is singing. But what other shows are we going to hear selections from?
Well, we're going to start with one of Andrew Lloyd Webber's earliest works, which is Joseph and the Amazing Technicolor Dreamcoat. We have a 9-minute suite from that featuring the Fredonia Chamber Choir. Then we will have the works from Evita, including Amanda Bottom singing Don't Cry for Me, Argentina. Jordan's on Oh, What a Circus and the Waltz for Eva and Che. Jesus Christ Superstar, we've got 4 numbers from that in Act 2. We have some solos from Memory from Cats with One Look from Sunset Boulevard. And we'll end with 4 numbers from Phantom of the Opera.
Well, to both of you gentlemen, first of all, thank you for giving me your time for the interview. I really appreciate it. Jordan, an absolute blessing for me to be able to talk to you. I hope to see you that night.
Thank you, Tom. Yeah, I'm really looking forward to seeing both of you and catching up properly in person. Yeah.
And Jefferson, of course, as always, good luck with the show. I'm sure it'll be a big hit. That's always one of the concerts that I know people at the in the region look forward to every year, and it should sell out, right?
So yes, I think we're going to do very well. And Tom, I promise you this, we will save you and your wife 2 aisle seats.
Okay. Done deal. Gentlemen, thank you very much. I appreciate your time.
Thanks.
Bye-bye.
Bye now.
The music of Andrew Lloyd Webber will be presented on Friday, May 19th, beginning at 7:30 p.m. in the King Concert Hall of the Rockefeller Arts Center. Tickets range from $35 to $20, depending upon seating, and are $5 and up for Fredonia students if purchased in advance. Call the Fredonia Campus box office at 716-673-3501 for more information or to purchase tickets. Or you can go online at www.fredonia.edu/tickets.
I'm watching the sunset on Tennessee hills. I wish I could capture it, I never will. I'm not a painter, can't stay in the lines. Just sitting here sipping on dandelion wine.
And that's it for this Dandelion edition of Notes from the Aisle Seat. My thanks to Alberto Ray, Dr. Robert Strauss, Jefferson Westwood, and Jordan Weatherston Pitts for being my guests on this episode. Notes from the Aisle Seat is a production of the 1891 Fredonia Opera House in Fredonia, New York. For more information on any of the Opera House's events, call the box office at 716-679-1891. Visit the website at www.fredopera.org or email at operahouse@fredopera.org. Notes from the Aisle Seat is now available wherever you get your podcasts and also on the Opera House YouTube channel. If you like this podcast, please consider following us by clicking the follow button on our home website at aisleseat.podbean.com and spreading the word through your social media feeds. If you have an arts event you'd like featured on the podcast, why don't you drop us a line at operahouse@fredopera.org and we'll see about featuring your event. Please try to give us a month's advance notice if possible to facilitate timely scheduling. If you have any suggestions, comments, or criticisms of the podcast, just drop us a line at operahouse@fredopera.org. We'll be glad to receive your feedback. Our next episode will be available on Wednesday, May 17th, 2023. I'm Tom Laughlin, and until then, be safe out there and be kind to one another. Just sit back and sip on that dandelion wine. Change most of the time.